AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 363 for February 3 of 2017, Engineering the Lincoln Continental. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Mr. Vasilash, Mr. Co-host Vasilash, how you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm doing peachy.
It's a busy week this week, and we'll get into a little bit later.
Oh, yeah. Lots of things going on in the industry.
Car in the studio, as we'll look at momentarily.
Well, let's get started, and we got to start by telling everybody Michelle Krebs is back in the house here.
Happy to be here.
Autotrader.com. She's probably the most quoted analyst in the business right now. Every time I pick up somebody reporting on something, it's Michelle Krebs saying this or that or the other thing.
That's what I do.
So it's great having you here, Michelle.
Thanks,
again.
Thanks for having me.
And our special guest today is Mike Sullentino. He's the chief engineer on the Lincoln Continental, and it's awesome having you here. And we've got one of your cars here, too.
It's great to be here, and I love talking about Continental, so it's great to share that with you today. So I look forward to our discussion.
As you came into the studio, you went, ooh, I like the color that you have here. So tell us, well, why don't we just start with that, the color of the car that's in the studio.
Well, this is burgundy velvet, which is one of our rich colors. I particularly like it. It's kind of got a burgundy wine, kind of red wine look to it.
And it looks edible.
It's just very elegant, I think. It's
potable.
fits in quite nice with our approach to elegance, and I think it just has a nice presence and when you're up close to it, the rich, deep color, it's very nice the way it reflects. I like it. And the contrast with the chrome, just a really nice presentation.
Continue this thought that you said there, your approach to elegance. You know, if you look at Cadillac, for example, they're going right, you know, frontal assault on the Germans, you know. And terrific cars, by the way, road holding, performance, cornering, acceleration, all that. You're talking elegance. Give us some of the philosophy behind how you approach doing this car.
Sure, John. We, with Lincoln, we've been talking about this essence of quiet luxury, and we've done, this is the fourth car that we've done since we started talking about quiet luxury, and we believe this is the, at this point in the journey, this is the best example of that. And one of the pillars of quiet luxury is design elegance, an elegant design. And like you said, it's not an in-your-face design, and there's many of luxury car companies that are designing cars to stand out, to very make a bold statement. Ours is more of an elegant statement, and that one that is a little more subtle, but something that when you look at the car a second or a third time, you see small personal details in the design that kind of make you feel good about the car. And there's a sort of an elegance to that. And we can talk some more about the design and what we've done very specifically to kind of lend more credence to the word elegance in the design.
Mm-hmm. Mike, but you're basically an engineer's engineer. I mean, you've been working engineering throughout
Thank
your career.
Thank you for that. I like that.
No, I mean, it's and so
proud of that.
I've got to ask you, so from the point of view of an engineer, how do you encompass that in this vehicle?
Well, the engineering, I mean, there's so many elements of it. First, we were on the design, so let's start with that. What we've done engineering-wise to create the ability for our studio to have an elegant design is we wanted to carry a full-length line on the car, right? And we came up with some innovations, particularly around the door handles. We call them one-touch entry, where we move the door handle up into the belt. And that's a clever engineering design with a microprocessor handle as opposed to the mechanical linkages. And that's exciting in itself because you can, with one touch, get in and out of the car, changing that experience. But the other really cool part is it gave us that freedom of that styling line. And it moved it out of the way. So aesthetically, it's pleasing. And then it's functionally better. So as an engineer, I love it because it's form and it's function. And it's innovative.
Right.
And it gave the studio folks who we, you know, it's so important that people like the car they're looking at. We gave them that freedom to design something. And there's more stories. I mean, The interior, we're very proud of the interior. We wanted to create what we call a serene interior. It has to be quiet. And so within that, as an engineer, active noise control. You know, we can get down into the things, the bandwidths of sound that are created and how we can cancel those. We've enhanced our noise control in the car. We've done a lot with special materials that absorb the sound. And the result of all that is really, really quiet interior. Mm-hmm. Really quiet. And then you can bring in a great stereo. You know, we have that Revel audio system. Or Sync Gen 3 when you're doing your connected calls. And all of those environments are enhanced by that beautiful, quiet interior. So I like how all of those things connect and create experiences. Like this technology executed creates an experience in the door handle to help the styling. The quiet interior creates an experience for the customer inside the car to have phone calls with their family or to listen to their favorite music. Mm-hmm. I like that part when you can engineer things that really speak to what the customer is looking for.
On that subject, the seats are rather special in this vehicle, too. I remember seeing those in the studio. So could you talk about
those? Thanks for asking. We're so proud of them. We call them the Lincoln Perfect Position Seat. And they're really part of that whole serene interior in terms of creating a comfortable environment for our customers. As an engineer, they have 30 ways of movement. But that it really wasn't about just that. That's what ended up being required to make sure we could get everybody and all their body types, all their different support requirements, so where they can get comfortable and they get into that perfect position. We've got really innovative features that we've engineered with our seat group, and we designed these seats inside, you know, the Ford Motor Company proper, and we're really proud of that. We have over 30 patents from that work. But, for example, in the thigh area, we have individual thigh supports in the seat. You can place your foot forward on the accelerator, get extended support from the thigh, and maybe you don't use the dead pedal on the other side. You could bring that side back and have a shorter cushion. Or maybe in the middle of your drive, you do want to extend, and you can change and adjust. And the beauty of all that, and you sort of wonder, am I going to have too much adjustment, is you can store all that in your memory position, and that'll be waiting for you when you come out of work or, you know, you get ready to get in the car. Of course, you can still get a massage in the seat. I drove over today, and I took a massage on the way here.
There you go.
To get ready, flexible, you have to deal with here.
Well, the sun was shining. I was feeling good. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a rarity around here, so I said, you know, I'm going to enjoy a massage. But, yeah, you can get a massage. You have heated, cooled seats. So, yeah, we're really, really proud of the seats. And visually, what do you think? I think they're different, and they look nice.
Well, I truly think you're onto something with the quiet luxury, because I think so many companies have gone to that responsive handling, you know, that whole, it's, and there's a segment of the population that is for, the enthusiast buyer. But I think there's a lot of us that's like, I don't want to work so hard. I don't want to, you know, I just want to relax.
So let me ask you, though. I mean, so, you know, responsive handling. I mean, so you had to make a car that drives well.
Yes.
So talk to us about some of the underpinnings that you know, I'm sure it drives differently, but it does what it's supposed to do in a good way.
Mm-hmm. And I think what Michelle said fits with what you're asking, and I'll try to help explain that. There's a large group of the population in the luxury segment that is looking for that, something different that's just more luxurious, more convenient. But Gary, what you said, it does have to drive well. Mm-hmm. And so we do have great technology. We're just delivering it in what we call an effortless, smooth manner, as opposed to something more performance-oriented or pure sport.
Yeah.
So the things that we've done to the car, we have the Lincoln exclusive 3-liter V6 twin turbo, 400 horsepower, 400 foot-pounds of torque, which the enthusiasts would like to hear those numbers. They are good numbers. Specific output's wonderful on that powertrain. But we deliver it in a smooth manner. We have an advanced all-wheel drive system that we pair with that powertrain standard. And we brought in torque vectoring with dynamic control, so it's not by braking. It actually adds speed to the outside wheel in a corner. And we have an adaptive steering system in the front that's a variable ratio. So what does all that do? Well, what it does, you know, back to Michelle's point about quiet luxury, is when you want to get up to speed on the highway, there's an abundance of power there for you. It's just brought to you in an effortless manner. When you're in a corner and maybe the surface gets a little bit slippery, you've got great technologies like torque vectoring and adaptive steering to make that transition very smooth for you. And what I say, and I've driven a lot of cars in my day, it's a big car, and it's intended to be a big car. It doesn't feel as big as the mass of the car with those technologies. So it gives the car an easiness, mm-hmm. a smoothness from the drive. But we did not tune it, say, to go around the Nürburgring, which many of our competitors have, and they talk about those times. We tuned it for those nice drives in the country or that comfortable drive on the highway. We do offer a sport mode, and you can get a more engaging drive, it's very simply, and we do offer a comfort mode, and you can move the car even more direction of comfort. And those are like 20 to 25% range changes for the suspension, the steering, and the shift schedules. So they're not dramatically changing, but they do give you a little more of an engaging drive or a more comfortable drive.
Mm-hmm. I know you're the engineer, but you've got some out on the road. You've sold some. What's the feedback from customers and who's buying them?
So the feedback has been good. I mean, we've done some outreach already with folks, and the feedback has been really good. People, like you say, they really like the overall interior and the comfort of the car. John was telling me before the show about feedback on the styling. We're getting that kind of, there's people that the styling speaks to, and we're so excited about that. And our research data had said there was a group of people out there that they like that elegance. So we're getting really good feedback, and the sales are good. I mean, we're actually slightly above our objectives on sales, and we couldn't be happier. Now, we're 3 months into the market, 3-4 months into the data, so it's still early days, but we really like the way the car is moving.
Is it sold in China now?
Yes, it is. Okay. It's on sale now.
How much of an influence was the thinking about the China market when you were developing this car?
It was quite a bit. When we first developed the car, admittedly, we had a very American view of it, and we thought, well, we're going to bring American luxury to China. And we researched in China, and it was a little different, a little different. A lot of things very similar with the customers, but a little more suitable for business was things we were hearing, and suitable back seat in particular, because the Chinese owner, they're more and more driving the cars than they were, say, 5 years ago. But they still have, at times, they want to ride in the back. And if you saw, and you probably maybe have been there, the cities and the congestion.
Yes.
If you had a business meeting across town, you can sit in the back of the car and have a productive discussion on the way to a project. And that's what they told us they wanted to do. And if you look at the back seat of this car, and we offer a package called Rear Seat Ambiance, where we put an ownership experience in the back, we call it. It's that great seat that I talked about. We put that almost all that functionality, heated, cool, massaged, recline, beautiful comfort headrests in the back, so you're very comfortable. And then in the center console, it folds down, and you have access to a full climate control. You have your own climate zone in the rear of the car, your audio controls. You can control the shading, the overhead shade, the back shade and the side window shade. So if you wanted to work on your iPad or something, you can do that. So, and then lastly, what I really like is on the passenger side, there's a switch in the back. You can take that seat in front of you far forward and even stretch your legs out. So that was developed from China feedback, and we loved it so much. We showed it to our American marketing team. They said, hey, we like it. And we offer it in America, and we're selling it. It's doing quite well, and Americans are enjoying that back seat as well.
We've got a question here from Bob Longmate from Long Island. He wants to know, other than tuning differences, is there any difference in the chassis, especially the length of the chassis, between the American and Chinese versions of the car?
No, we really have, this is what we call the extended length car for the world. It's really, this is the same wheelbase in both regions, and if you look at the Audi A6L, which was a car we really looked at, this is very similar in size, if not just a bit larger. Mm-hmm. So we said, hey, that's a good size. We're going to bring that to America as well. So that's the way we sized it.
So this basically replaces the MKS, which you'd worked on. And you're talking about the size. I mean, this is a big car, 201.4 inches long and a wheelbase of 117.9 inches. I mean,
that's a good size.
It's a good size car.
It's a very, very roomy vehicle.
Yeah. And it needs to be. I mean, our customers in both regions said they wanted an exceptional backseat. They really wanted a great experience. There's a great Matthew McConaughey ad. I love it, where he crosses his leg in the back seat and says, you know, ride in the back. That really, I mean, that's a paraphrase of it, but that really captures what we want. We want a very spacious and comfortable back seat. So that's the car we design.
We've got a lot more questions to get to. We got to take a real quick commercial break right now. Well, let's give a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexis offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back with Mike Salentino talking about the Lincoln Continental. We got another quick question here. Dale Leonard from Cleveland wants to know, if this is your flagship vehicle, why was it not rear-wheel drive?
Well, our customers really haven't, you know, when we talked about luxury and we went out and did this quiet luxury research and we did the same research in China, we didn't really get a lot of feedback that said we definitely need a rear-wheel drive. What we got feedback was we want a car that drives great, has the package that you talked about, and handles well and meets our requirements. And our view is we are delivering that. We have, you know, we do offer an all-wheel drive variation on this, and the car I talked about with the 3-liter is standard all-wheel drive. So when we looked at our customer feedback and we looked at both regions, we felt this car could deliver and deliver and meet their requirements.
Is there any engineering reason why an electric car would need to be rear-wheel drive? I mean, I don't think we're worried about torque steer with this thing. I mean, it's...
No, I think that there are... the studio styling folks would tell you there are some architectural differences, and you work your way around them.
For proportions.
Proportions, yeah. And things like that. And we just talked about the styling and how we wanted to deliver elegance. So we believe we've delivered in terms of there's a sleekness to the car, there's a length, there's a lowness, a profile to it. But I think rear drive can help you in some ways in terms of packaging things, especially in the dash area, so there are some advantages.
Isn't there some isolation too, especially through the steering wheel, that you can get with a rear drive car?
I think you can. I think we've done a super job on the isolation with this in terms of the subframe and the gear isolation. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think you'll be driving the car. The isolation has really done well on this.
And then you're able to electronically tune the steering, basically, right? I mean, you have electric assist.
Well, we have an electronic power-assisted steering, and then I mentioned earlier adaptive. So we can change the effort as a function of speed. We can change the ratio, so the number of turns to steer it. And so that kind of we can manage the responsiveness of the car. Mm-hmm. And that delivers a lot of that smoothness that we talked about. It also gives you a lot less lock-to-lock turns in a parking lot situation, which people really appreciate. Mm-hmm.
Did you do anything in terms of the structural engineering that we don't see under this skin to make it?
We did a lot. I mean, there is, you know, there's so much of the car that's, you know, ground up new. We did a lot in terms of it's an all-new suspension, all-new wheelbase, all-new track width. We've done a lot with alloy steels for structural integrity. And, you know, we sell a lot of these cars with this glass roof in the car. So we did a lot with the two-part epoxy adhesive to create a structural adhesive because glass isn't always bonded to the body so well. You don't get good bonding for structural response. So we developed, and I think we're one of the only companies that uses that adhesive. And it's about a 15% improvement in the torsional response of the car. And this boron elements in the B pillar, it allows you to lightweight the car and still have the tensile stress that you need for rollover safety and so forth to achieve the safety requirements. So we did that. We did some lightweighting in the front of the car. We've got, you know, aluminum hood, fenders, aluminum deck lid in the car as well. There's quite a bit in the structure.
Like, I know you won't reveal secrets about future product, but can you talk about what does this car say about where Lincoln's going? and future products.
You know, it's a, we've said all along the luxury business is a journey, and it takes time. And we said some time ago that we were going to deliver 4 cars in 4 years. So think of it this is the capstone of that statement. But we also have come out and said, you know, we did a Navigator concept I think last year in New York that was a big hit. And so you get a sense of where we're going with that. And we've not denied that we've got a new Navigator coming. I can't go much beyond that, but there is several more steps that we will take on the Lincoln journey. And our goal is continually to advance forward with each of those new products. And there are some great products coming. There are.
We got another question here from the audience. Matt Shalito would love to have you elaborate on the long-term reliability considerations that you took when producing this vehicle. He says the old Continentals would run till the wheels fell off.
Well, that's a good comment. I love that. And everybody likes to hear that, you know, the cars that we've engineered in the past have done well. And we've had good luck with our engineering, sort of our engineering processes at Ford. We, the Ford Motor Company and Lincoln in particular, well, we have such a diligent plan in how we develop a product and even down at the component level, how we do what we call our life cycle testing and how we take everything out and in many life cycles beyond 150,000 miles. We do that on all the systems first. So we do that on the seats. We do that on the suspension. Then we put those together and we do all of that again on the total vehicle system. And we do that multiple times. We do that virtually first. We're so good with our tools now, we can do that in CAD. We can do those simulations. And then we build early prototypes that are primarily the platform. We call those M1s. We do that whole process again, validating. And then we build what we call engineering prototypes, which look very much like the car we have today. They're built in a special pilot plant. And we do those development processes completely again. So there's several prove-out cycles of durability all the way to the completed vehicle. And then when we get in the manufacturing phase, we do another step called PV, which looks at manufacturing variation, and we do those same durability cycles again. So when someone tells me the prior Continentals ran well, we're the same company with those processes being improved and improved and improved, and we expect this product will do exactly the same based on our standards.
You mentioned the A6L as being something that you guys benchmarked. What are some of the other cars that you looked at?
Well, we looked at, obviously, Cadillacs. We looked at, we didn't have CT6s available. We looked at CTS and XTS extensively. We looked at the BMW 5, in particular the 5L. And then later in the sort of the development, we looked at the Mercedes as well, the E-Class and the E-Class L. And a little bit of look at, I believe, the Infiniti and the Lexus GS. The GS is a bit smaller, but it's a good product to look at from an engineering execution. But I really would say the A6L, the Cadillacs, and the BMW were really key in our benchmarking process.
This car strikes me as a perfect car to offer self-driving, the option of self-driving. Might that be in the cards?
Well, you know, driver assist technology is very important. And what we do have, it's not a full, you know, SAE level 4. Obviously, that's going to take time, and we've made our announcements about that. But with this car, what we wanted to do was focus on conveniences and luxuries. So we do have full adaptive cruise control with stop and go, which I use all the time. It doesn't steer, but it can handle the car in a sort of a traffic jam, stop-and-go situation. It's wonderful. We have the collision assist with pedestrian detection, which will stop the car for you or help you stop the car if a collision is pending. We've got all the sensors to do that. We have the lane-keeping assist. So we have the full suite of driver assist. The car will park itself, parallel, perpendicular, pull in or out. But, yeah, we're going to continue, as we continue to do more cars, we continue to add more assist technologies, and that's in the cards. I can confidently say we're studying all those things now for future applications, and I personally am enjoying those features myself, and I think our customers are as well.
We got a question from MJB, which He asked the question, I really like it, because I think the same thing. He wants to know, why are the front ends of the MKZ and the Continental all but indistinguishable? He says, I see these cars on the streets all over the Detroit area, but I can never tell which one it is until I get a glimpse of the rear three-quarter.
Well, you want to have a name or a brand recognition, and we moved to the new single grille for Lincoln, and we wanted to take the two sedans in that direction simultaneously.
And not just them, because, as you mentioned, you've shown it on the Navigator.
Yeah, it's coming on everything. There is, and maybe we have to look a little closer, there is a subtle difference. If you look at the lamps and in the signature treatment, there is a subtle difference between the Z and the Continental.
Okay,
there's a slight kick up in the Z. It's got a little bit more curvature in the signature, and the lamps are slightly different. And that is something that we'll work on as we go forward, is keeping that family recognition, but finding small little things to distinguish between the brands. But if you told me that you always saw those as Lincolns, then I would be happy. But yeah, we want to make sure there's subtle things that are different between a Continental and the sister products. Mm-hmm.
And back to Bob Longmaid here. He wants to know, when's that 9-speed going to go in here? The 9-speed you got a 6-speed now, right?
We're not making any announcements about that. But
nice try, Bob.
Yeah.
So you have three engines, a 3.7.
So in the U.S., yeah, we have the 3.7 V6, naturally aspirated. We have a 2.7 twin turbo V6. And then we have the 3-liter, which is exclusive to Lincoln. Mm-hmm. In China, we offer a 2-liter turbo 4-cylinder as well.
And that's in China, or are they all made in the U.S. right now?
They're all made in the U.S.
But they will be made in China if sales get to some magic number?
We're always looking at that. We have no announcements on that, but we're always evaluating if a given region, supports its own manufacturing.
Because that's got to hurt you, right? There's a big import tax on American-made cars in China.
There is. Yes, there is a big import tax. But where we're at now building the brand, it's the right situation. But like I said, we're always considering those. But there's no formal announcements.
Okay.
So since this car it's already been fully baked, Genesis brand launched. Did you look at that car after the fact and say, gee, they did this well, or I'm glad we did this and they didn't do this, or...
I've only looked at that briefly. There's been a lot of discussion about the Genesis, and the Volvo actually was out at about the same time too. And I've done some research on that, but not. I can't definitively. I feel like when I talk about the Audi or the BMW, I'm coming from a full data set. Mm-hmm. In past years, Genesis they've been good products. I think we have a bit of a different proposition here with their design and what we're saying, but I mean they have always been good products. So I have not personally evaluated that car.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we've got more questions. We ought to get to some of them. In fact, we got a phone call here. Carmen, let's bring that one in.
Hey, this is Danny from Cleveland, Ohio, calling. I have two questions, different realms. First one's for the Lincoln engineer. That monster of a V6 twin turbo that they have in that Continental, might that be used in a performance application through Ford Motor Company someplace? Like now that the Mustang V6 is discontinued, maybe? Okay, well, second question, in that Rolex over the weekend, they have that prototype class PC, a couple of the entrants, and I think it was second place finisher, had a Gibson engine designated as its powertrain. What the hell is a Gibson engine? Thanks. Bye.
Okay, so on the first one, I mean, it's a good question. It's a great engine. The 3-liter is a great engine, and the horsepower I quoted is awesome. I mean, 400 horsepower out of a 3-liter. So I appreciate what you're asking, and we love Mustangs at the Ford Motor Company. They're great products. But there's a selfish part on we're Lincoln, and we want to keep that.
You got to keep that identity.
We want to keep that to ourselves.
Right.
But I can't disagree from a pure engineering standpoint. It's a great engine, and it might have some use there, but we have no plans for that. It's a Lincoln exclusive 3-liter. I can't answer on the Gibson. I don't know if you. I watched the race all weekend.
Very, very little bit about it. It's an engine developed in England. It's purely for racing applications, is my understanding. And now you know as much as I do, because I had the same reaction. What the hell's a Gibson engine?
Mm-hmm.
So good question on that. Let's see. Just going through some quick ones here. Cozy Cole said he just saw the Continental at the Philly Auto Show yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
He found the door handles interesting. He said, sadly, the car was locked, so I couldn't see the interior, but he says, nice car.
Thank you.
Jonathan Brown is a frequent viewer of this. He says, I'm not a Lincoln owner, rather a Cadillac owner at this time. That new Continental intrigues me, he says, and wants to know, will James Bond's arch enemy have a chauffeur driving a Lincoln Continental in the next James Bond movie?
Oh, he's going back to the, was it Jaws? That was a great scene where there was a bad guy driving. I don't know the answer to that. We'll have to ask our public affairs team if there's a, but no, I don't know of any plans for that. But you'll see Matthew McConaughey driving one.
Yeah, Abby wants to know, what was the most challenging engineering work on the car?
I think delivering the seats, to be honest. We put so much effort into the seats, and we were chasing the innovation, and we really were pushing hard for it. I'm so glad we did it. But kind of candidly, when we said we were going to do it, we were worried about could we get it all done. And, you know, it was such a move for us. There was so much new that we were doing, and happily we did. And it's being very well received. So that would be my, you know, top of the mind thing. And then for us, you know, the ride, we spent a lot of time on the ride.
Mm-hmm.
My VE team would want me to mention that because we spent so much.
And especially having different settings, there's a lot of parameters to engineer there.
And with the quiet luxury message, you know, we talked about the quietness, but the ride really has to be subtle and it really has to deliver and has to be comfortable. We spent a lot of time on the ride.
How much did you and your team, when did you start working on this vehicle?
Well, you know, I've personally been on it probably almost 5 years now. Now, we're 3 months past launch, but, you know, we had a little bit of a fit in a fumble at start because we wanted a certain car, and we didn't know what it was going to be called, and we kept testing it, and Californians liked what we had, and Chinese market didn't, and then we'd get a car China liked, and then to our leadership's credit, I think it was Mark Fields, Jim Farley, and Raj, they came in and said, we're designing a Continental. And there was something about that just kind of freed us to say, well, we're not searching for what to design. We know what a Continental is. It wasn't to be retro, but we knew that it was always a statement in terms of style and elegance. Somebody, one of the executives, parked a Mark II Continental in the studio, and we had a 61, and you know, we had various, and that just kind of galvanized everything. And I'd say that process took a little bit longer than normal. But mm-hmm. once we got that, it researched in both markets very well at the same time, which was just. And there's a saying in the business: if the people that are working on the car love it, you know, the day to day people, you learn a lot right there. And when we got to that point. Unanimously, you'd walk around the studio and I'd ask somebody, maybe just helping with the clay or doing something, and they'd say, I really like this. This is, you guys, we're on to something. So we got that feeling mm-hmm. when we made that change to the Continental.
It must have been cool working on such a legendary nameplate.
It was incredible, and I had a good fortune of going out to the Lincoln Heritage Museum out in Kalamazoo area, and you can see Continental from history, and it's just so fabulous. This car is parked there as well in the museum. It's fabulous. I love it. So, yes.
Well, Mike Celentino, thanks so much for coming on Autoline After Hours today and talking all about the Continental. I think you got a winner on your hands. The sales look pretty good, and it's just the beginning.
Yeah.
I don't even think the country is aware of the car just yet. You've only just gotten going with this television advertising with Michael McConaughey, so... Kudos to you guys. Looks like you got a winner.
Thank you. Thank you. We hope so. Yes.
Well, thanks. We're going to take another quick break and come back and talk about some of the other things going on in the industry. But pleasure having you here on the show.
It's great to be here, and it's great to talk about Continental with you guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
from Shanghai to the Silicon Valley, the auto industry may make news around the globe, but there's only one spot to get your daily dose. Check out AutoLine Daily at AutoLine.tv, Monday through Friday at noon Eastern.
And it's always the time of the show for Dr. Data.
Okay, so it's good Michelle's here because she knows about sales and things like that.
Yeah.
So this is going to be a quiz for you guys, okay? So Carmen, could you please bring up the first slide? All right, so here we have the five passenger brands in China, and I just...
The top five.
Top five, and I just realized, and this is my fault, that this should read China 2016.
Okay, we get it.
So last year sales.
Okay.
Okay.
So let's name them. Hyundai, Volkswagen, Honda, Buick, and Changan.
Correct. So what I want you guys to do is put them in correct order.
Oh, Lord.
No, we can do that. Number one, Volkswagen.
Volkswagen, yeah.
Number two, Buick.
Buick, yeah.
Number three, Hyundai. Number four, Honda. Yeah, number five, that. Chang'an. That's what I would say.
Boy, you guys are good.
Is that right?
No.
Oh.
All right. So Carmen, bring up the answers. So there we have it.
Okay.
Oh, my God. Hyundai that far down? Hyundai was at the...
But if you sort of look at it, I mean, the difference between...
The numbers are very close.
Yeah, it's very close. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so you basically, after you get from Volkswagen, the thing that absolutely floored me, again, this is 2016, not 2017, my fault, is the fact that I looked at that Buick number, and remember there was all that discussion about, you know, why is Buick being capped and get rid of Buick? And so... Okay, so that number was basically that they sold 1,230,000 vehicles in China last year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They sold 229,000 vehicles in the U.S. last year.
Mm-hmm.
A million more Buicks
in China
were sold in China. A million.
Of course, remember, they have a different product line, too.
Yeah.
I get it. The numbers are huge.
I mean, isn't that breathtaking?
That's why they kept Buick.
I just couldn't get over that.
Yeah. Not only that, Buick had a bad month in the U.S. last month. Their sales were off significantly.
Yeah, the cars are just not doing well there, so.
Right.
That's their big problem.
But sales were one of the big stories.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. And it was an interesting month. I mean, we anticipated there would be some hangover because the deals in December were just screaming.
Well, that's how I'm describing January. It's the December hangover.
It's the December hangover, but it's not horrible. It's like a minor headache. But there were some companies that, I mean, Toyota was the shocker. Down 11%. Lexus down 25%,
something like that.
Yeah,
Lexus is really...
So, shocker to me was Volvo, which had the biggest decline of anybody. And it was down like 18%. And it was the XC90 and the S90 that were off.
Yeah, Volvo down 18.2%, Lexus 25.6%.
I can't explain
the Volvo one, but...
No, I can't either. I put a call into them. I never heard back from them to see what the hell... You know, sometimes... The ship sank, or we didn't get the allocation we needed, or
and
whatever.
I have not looked at inventory numbers.
Yeah.
But that's the story that we're seeing is it's taken a lot more effort to sell vehicles these days. There were a lot more incentives. Inventories are still rising despite all the incentives we saw. Mm-hmm. So of course, this week we saw some plant, trimming production again. GM trimming production at. Lordstown, Ohio, where they build the Chevy Cruze, for example.
Yeah, the Cruze didn't do too badly last year.
I'm wondering if there's... Well, they had some pretty hefty incentives in December. I haven't looked at what they were in January, but... and you never know. Sometimes a fleet order goes in there that makes them pop up.
Right. I mean, they were up 39% for Cruze sales.
Okay, but let's check the inventories, because the inventories are getting blown. That's why they're cutting production. So.
But the thing that I found in terms of sales that was absolutely astonishing is like... It almost seems as though you're putting a fork in sedans. They're over. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
It never ends.
I mean,
the downward trend
never
ends.
It was just crazy. I mean, it was just like, so I looked at, each of the car makers. And so Accord was down 5.9%. There's like 19,000 and change. CR-V, 29,287. Mm-hmm. Wow. The number one selling non-pickup truck vehicle was the Honda CR-V.
Mm-hmm.
Then... Over at Acura, this
you know, talk about cars having a problem. So if you add up ILX, NSX, RL, and TLX, you come up with a grand total of 2,726 cars.
Whoa, okay? Not even 3,000.
MDX was down 8.4%, yet it sold 3,274 vehicles. I mean, so just that one vehicle outsold mm-hmm. all their cars.
Mm-hmm.
Camry, you know, you were talking about Toyota being
down.
Well,
and that's what Toyota's problem.
I mean, it was down 24.3%. The RAV4 outsold it. So,
and they have been predicting that for quite some time, that even that the RAV4 would be number one at some point.
Uh-huh. Right.
Lexus ES was down 36%. Now,
here's the other thing. Jeep sales down.
Yes.
But now it's 2 months in a row they're down.
Two or three, I think.
Maybe three. But what's going, I mean.
Now, remember, they had to recalculate some numbers there, too.
Yeah, I don't think that's it. I think. Cherokee sales are way down.
25%.
Yeah, what the hell's going on? This is an SUV market, and it's not down like a little bit. What, mm-hmm. You said what, 25%?
25%.
That's a big drop.
I don't know. Are some quality problems catching up with?
Well, I think part of it might be Renegade has eaten into it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is
up 52%.
Right.
Yeah. But even so,
and a lot more competition, you know, just mm-hmm. a lot more competition.
I wonder if it's quality issues.
That's what I've wondered, because you buy one, you have some quality issues, you don't go buy another one, maybe. I don't know.
But, yeah. Okay, would you put Cherokee up against RAV4, CR-V, Equinox, Escape?
I think it's in that category,
isn't it?
I would say it's a little bit bigger.
But
I'm not
would
sure.
that be a cross shop, though?
Yeah, I think it could be.
Probably.
Yeah.
So maybe those other cars are, if you think about it, when Cherokee came out because of its styling, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. people, ooh, this is different. This is new. And now it's been out for a few years. They've freshened the RAV4. There's a new mm-hmm. CR-V.
Good point.
You know,
well, and also, there seems to be, remember when anybody who tried to do something different with minivans was a total failure. Same, it seems like the crossover, there's a certain recipe that works, they all look pretty much the same,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of stray from that, you're only going to have limited success, it seems
right.
like. That's my guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, speaking of minivans, Pacific is saving
yes,
Chrysler's
indeed.
Bacon.
I don't know.
Their number's bad, but if they didn't have Pacifica?
Right.
Right.
But, I mean, it's substantially below where Town and Country was. Substantially
yes.
below.
Yes.
And that's got to be a worry, because Odyssey and Sienna are really pulling a sales gap, whereas...
And Odyssey's going to be new. And one that goes on sale, but we saw that at the auto show.
End of the year, yeah.
And the Pacific is pretty pricey. That's why they're keeping the Grand Caravan on. They have not given an end date for that, and because it's for budget shoppers. But, you know, the Pacific is pretty pricey.
Mm-hmm.
It's a terrific vehicle.
Oh, totally.
And I say that because the Odyssey can be pretty pricey. Sienna
yes,
can be pretty pricey.
Yes, they can.
Well, but, you know, I mean, what the average transaction price for a car now is like
almost $35,000.
$35,000. Isn't that amazing?
It's breathtaking.
Yeah.
And the average...
Income in this country is like $52,000.
Right. Guess what? Those average income households are not buying.
No, they are not.
I mean, it's pretty much conclusive that it takes households of $75,000 a year mm-hmm. income and above to go out and buy a new car.
Right.
I mean, that's really where the market is.
Sure, sure.
But
there will be lots of used cars.
Speaking of missing sales and consequences thereof. As we closed out last week's show, Gary, we had just learned that Robert Davis had been demoted at Mazda North America.
Well, he's been reassigned.
Well, it's a demotion.
We had him on the show.
I think the guy's terrific.
Yep.
I think Mazda's got rocks in its head. It's doing this. But you got to call it like you see it. He's been demoted.
Right. And that I love that brand. I love their vehicles. But they have a hard time getting their voice heard in the market.
I went back and I looked at sales.
Sales haven't budged.
A decade ago.
Right.
Kia and Mazda were about the same size.
Mm-hmm.
Subaru and Volkswagen were far, far, far behind. These days, Kia has doubled in size.
Right.
Subaru tripled in size.
Yeah.
Even Volkswagen is out, even with all its problems, mm-hmm. Volkswagen is outselling Mazda.
Yeah.
And Mazda sales last year were almost exactly the same as they were 10 years ago.
So what's your theory on why?
It's got to be a marketing problem.
I love
their product.
I do too.
Like the way it drives. I don't know anybody. I've never heard anybody say, I hate Mazda. That company sucks. I've never heard that.
Right.
Everybody seems to have a nice image of them.
They don't buy the cars.
So it's a dealer problem, or it's a marketing problem,
awareness,
or it's both.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So for those of you watching at home who don't know who Robert Davis is, he was previously the senior vice president of U.S. operations for Mazda North America.
And operations people, they're the execs who really run the show.
So now he has a newly created role of senior vice president special assignments. So
whenever you're put on special assignment, that is not a good thing.
Right. So, I mean, if you look at their sales last year, I mean, they were not good. I mean, they sold 297,773 cars, which was down 6.7% from the previous year. And, you know, I think a problem that company has, though, is that, okay, if I were to say to you, Michelle, where is there a Mazda dealer around here? Would you know?
No.
I know where one is.
Isn't it right over there?
I forgot about that one over there.
I only knew that because when I was driving in, somebody made a turn into that. I thought, oh, look at that Mazda. That's a nice looking car.
But, you know, I don't think, oh, what dealer is around? I'll go look there for. I think of a car. I think most people do that. I think of a car and now
but
I go look.
But that's the problem. They aren't thinking. That's why
they're
I say it's an awareness.
Right.
They're not on the shopping list, I don't think.
You know, if you go back 20 years ago, they hit it out of the park with the Zoom advertising campaign. And then, I mean, they still use Zoom, you know, as sort of like a subtext.
But like you said, they didn't have the competitive Kia, Hyundai, Subaru. I mean, Subaru's just been an amazing story. So speaking of leadership changes,
BMW,
which is another brand that's not doing
in the U.S.
really well. Uh-uh.
No, so it looks to me like Ludwig Wilisch, who has been running BMW North America, got kicked upstairs, as they say. They brought in
special assignment.
They brought in a new CEO for North America, and this guy has been running sales operations for BMW Global in imported markets, i.e., where they don't manufacture. And then they brought in some other, or I guess they promoted some other sales guy that they've got there. But you're right, Michelle.
That's a story no one has written about in the last year because their sales have been soft.
Nowhere.
And their incentives have been eye-popping.
Yeah.
I think they closed the year $6,000 a car. I mean, there have been months that they were among the highest at the top.
So, I mean, I think the issue is people are going to look and they say, well, BMW is actually up like 0.1% in January, but last year, for the year, they were down 9.7%.
Wow. So they're barely up off a bad month.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, so, you know, to your point, man, are they
there's a product problem in that they are more heavily focused on cars when a market wants sport utilities. And in fact, we've seen that's even more dramatic in the luxury car market. We've got a chart that just shows luxury sport utilities this way, luxury cars this way. And then I think, you know, we saw the new 5 Series at the Detroit show.
I interviewed Ludwig Wilisch then and asked him, I said, look, it looks to me like you had a pretty tough year. And he says, no, it wasn't that tough. He says, I just can't get the allocation I need. You know, BMW's plant in South Carolina is their biggest plant.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. It is the number one export plant from the United States of America.
Yes.
And he says, the problem is our SUVs are so popular all over the world, I can't get allocation. He said, I got 40% last year. He said, I could have taken 60%. But then I saw the new guy quoted today saying that 70% of that is getting exported. So I don't know if I totally buy that it's just an allocation issue, but that was how he explained why their sales haven't been that great, because he can't get enough SUVs.
Well, and they can't move cars, because that's why you put $6,000 on the hood.
Yeah, I mean, and you look at their car sales for last year, I mean, they all have negative signs in front of them, and they're all basically almost in double digits. I mean, it's crazy, whether you're talking about the i3, which is down 30.8%, or the, what is this one, 6 Series, down 51.5%. Now, the Z4 sold fine.
Yeah, but the numbers are what?
Yeah, tiny.
Count them with your fingers and toes,
well,
right?
They 28,000 they sold. Let's see what else this is. 7 Series did okay. It was up 39%, but that was like 13,000 units. But, I mean, but just, you know, like last year, the 3 Series ended down 25.5%.
Right.
And that was like the most desirable car of, you know, to show that you've arrived, right?
The yuppie mobile.
Yeah. So what is it now? I mean, what is the vehicle that people would say, I've arrived and that's why I got to buy this car?
Well, in that segment, I would say, especially younger buyers, we think Audi is the brand for that they're going after. All our studies show that's an aspirational brand for more affluent millennials aging.
Mm-hmm. Hey, we got to take another quick break. We got several more topics. We got to get to Bosch. Oh. We got to get to Lincoln Company. Not Lincoln, Link and Company. Mm-hmm. So, Carmen, let's give a good shout out to our friends at Bridgestone. We're back. What else you got on the list there, Gary?
All right. So you mentioned the Link and Co. They call it Co. They don't. I discovered this. So, Automotive News had their retail forum in New Orleans this past week, and
the National Automotive Dealers Association.
Right. And Elon Visser, who is a senior vice president, made a presentation there, and he made the presentation.
He's from Link and Co.
He's a senior VP of Link and Co. And he basically said, you know, I'm talking to you dealers out there, and I'm, you know, people didn't think I'd come onto the stage because basically they're talking about direct sales.
I.e., no dealers.
No dealers.
I.e., like Tesla.
But this guy's presentation, I thought was, I mean, if there's going to be sort of a tipping point in terms of automobiles, these guys may be the ones that are making this happen. So, you know, you can order it online, they'll deliver it to your house. Okay.
And explain it. You don't buy the car. It's a subscription.
A 2-year subscription.
We should also talk about the companies behind this.
Oh, yeah, we will. But let's talk about this first, because this might be a very clever end run legally around franchise laws.
So basically he said they're not going to communicate the price of the vehicle, but its monthly fee. It'll be a subscription for 2 years, then you'll turn it in for another. And this was also very interesting, and he made the point that you turn it in for another, or you turn it in to the company, therefore they control the residual value, okay? And he said that
theoretically they may
take...
There is this thing called the market.
Right,
yes,
I mean, just
exactly.
Saying, but they would know how many vehicles would be out there, so they'd be able to control that.
Right.
All right, mm-hmm. Okay. And so they're even thinking about maybe modifying those vehicles that get turned in, so then they'd have another channel to get them out.
CPO, baby.
Yeah.
They have what they're calling a, quote, lean product offering, close quote, 8 build combinations, 1 engine, 1 transmission, no options, and there's just colors. There'll be an app that will be built into every vehicle so you can have car sharing. So if you want to share your car at a certain point in time, they'll do it. They're saying that the distribution cost for any vehicle manufacturer is on the order of 25%. They think they can cut that in half. So, Michelle, I got to ask you, since you track this stuff fairly carefully, is this real?
You know, I don't know. We are going to see a lot of experimentation because we know there are a lot of things about the buying experience that people don't like, you know, being at the dealership too long. And, you know, our studies show over and over, they want to do more of the process online. The one thing I would say that's different is they really want more test drive time. So I don't know how they will deal with that. I mean, we are seeing that our studies are showing they want more time to test drive the car without the sales guy in the car, and they want more time to focus on the technology and see if, like we're telling them, take a separate test drive of the technology. Mm. So I don't know how that plays with it. But, you know, we are going to see subscription types of things or different kinds of ways of the business model. But it'll be interesting to see how do they deal with all of the regulatory agencies
was talking at NADA to dealers because he does want dealers to sign up, but not at, you know, not with a showroom and sales mm-hmm. force. He wants them to service the cars,
right.
If I understand
because
this correctly.
Right. We'll have to do that.
Well, he was saying that basically if you look at it, I mean, that's where the money is in a retail mm-hmm. store now. It's not in selling the vehicle. It's in fixing the vehicles. And so
there would be that. I mean, we've talked about, you know, the autonomous vehicle. I mean, mm-hmm. they're going to need a lot of repair, right? I mean, yep. that would be where the dealers would come into play. But, you know, he was saying it was sort of interesting. He walked through the history of the auto industry, and he basically said that, and he's worked at car companies, and so he knows, you know, so he's just not pulling this out of his nether world. And he basically said all the discussions tend to be about engineering, about powertrains, about suspension setups, and on and on and on. And he says, and you know what? Most of the young people who are going to buy cars could care less about that stuff.
So true.
What did I just say about the Lincoln? Right. You know, there are a huge segment of the buyers that don't care about that kind of, all the details of it. Just make it work the way I want it to work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and so he's and so they, of course, and he showed a film which, you know, had all the young people that everybody on earth wants to sell to, right? I mean, they're cool, they're mm-hmm. hip, they skateboard, you know, they do all these things that
and a subscription kind of situation, it makes it more affordable, supposedly,
right? Like, I mean, like a cell phone.
That's why leasing works.
So at the end of this ad or movie or film or whatever, which he said is, we basically show this internally, we don't show this, but I'm going to show you people this anyway, and there was this basically a slogan: no frills, no layers, no bullshit. And you know, and there it was
in their presentation. Well, dealers love that kind of talk, you mm-hmm. know, quote unquote straight talk.
So it's supposed to launch in the United States in early 19.
Geely Volvo kind of deal, is that, do I have that correct?
It's Geely.
Well, Geely is the parent company.
Parent right. company, yes.
Geely owns Volvo.
Right.
Geely makes cheap-ass cars, but they want to position this Lincoln Company, or Lincoln Co., between Volvo and the rest of the okay. Geely lineup. And it's our good friend Peter Horbury, who's been mm-hmm. busy at work designing mm-hmm. these things, who used to work at
right.
Volvo and you
Ford.
And at Ford. So, mm-hmm. I mean, they only got one of the best ever that's right. been in the business mm-hmm. to design this for.
Right, so it's Volvo, Ford, back to Volvo. Then
now Geely
running.
See, and this, it's interesting because when Tesla started and, you know, got in all the trouble with franchise laws and wanted to sell to customers directly, I kept telling reporters that would call me, it's not just about Tesla. You know, it's like, why are they keeping this innovative company out? Because they don't want the Chinese to take that same route. And, you know, I just came from a talk about Chinese automakers working their way into the U.S. in various ways. And I think this will be an interesting test.
It sure will be.
So John, you spent the good part of the weekend watching television.
I did. I watched the 24 hours of Daytona. It was terrific. I don't know what it is. You know, I get so bored by NASCAR races. It's like, oh, my God, these things, they go around for hours. And, you know, I look at Formula One, and it's pretty boring, you know, unless there's, you know, the pit stops. Maybe somebody passes somebody in the pits. And Indy's pretty good, but I was glued to the TV. I must have watched 10 hours of that stupid race.
And you still can see.
And I'm trying to still figure out, why am I so enthralled by this thing? Because, like I said, you know, 4 hours of NASCAR, it's way too long.
Mm-hmm.
10 hours of endurance racing, 10 of the 24 that I probably watched, I didn't want to go to sleep. I couldn't wait to wake up and go watch the rest of the race.
Lost on me, sorry.
But what was also interesting is, I wish I could remember the number off the top of my head. There's 14 different OEMs or OEM brands participating. You know, here's other racing series, you know, begging automakers to get involved. And this World Endurance stuff is, they've cracked the code.
All right, so we asked what a Gibson one, but what's an Orca?
Yeah,
whale?
Orca.
That's what I thought.
I believe, and again, I'm, you know, there's people in the audience who are going to be laughing at what I'm saying, but I believe it's a French racing team.
Well, it's an Orca FLM09.
Yeah, well, that's probably the body style that Orca built for.
Yeah, so it's interesting to your point. They have Cadillac, Nissan, Ford, Porsche, Ferrari, BMW. Arica, Audi, Mercedes.
I'm not even counting Arica when I count OEMs.
Okay.
Aston Martin.
Let's see, Lamborghini. Did I already say that? Acura, mm-hmm. Aston Martin.
Lexus.
Lamborghini, Ligier, Lexus, Ferrari. Yeah, there's all kinds of.
So why were you so intrigued?
That, you know, I think part of it is there's four different categories. So there's really four races in one. There's always some sort of action going on. And when you get into the GTLM and the GTD categories, I mean, these are essentially cars, production cars that have been heavily modified, mm-hmm. as opposed to just purpose-built cars. You've got pure prototypes, two categories of prototypes as well. But so you've got four different kinds of cars, four different categories, lots of cars. I don't know. There's probably, 60 cars entered in the race or something like that, 40 or plus. And so, like I said, at any turn, on any lap, at any minute, there's always some action going on. And I got to believe that's what it is. And it really is grinded out. You know, in the not-so-old days, you'd baby the car. You know, you'd get out, and then you'd baby the car, and then the last couple of hours you'd really go at it just to try to get to the end of the 24. These days the cars are so reliable, it's damn near and flat-out sprint for 24 hours. I just find it intriguing, you know. But I've always loved motor racing. I just think that these guys have got it right. I think maybe the TV numbers and the track attendance numbers don't show it. To me, it's the best racing going right now.
And mentioning NASCAR, Jeff Gordon won.
Jeff Gordon was in the winning car. And that was what was also so interesting. Race drivers from all different kinds of categories. You know, ex-Formula One, Indy, NASCAR, a bunch of other things, too. It's just a great series.
Yeah, I thought one of the best quotes I'd ever seen from a race victor was some guy named Joey Hand, who he was driving a Ford GT, and they won the GT LM class. And so I don't know if you maybe.
I am not a racing fan.
So basically, I mean, because they're doing 24 hours, they do stints, right?
Yeah,
so
you have
they had three different drivers, and so it was Joey Hand, Dirk Mueller, and Sebastian Bourdais. And this is a quote from this Joey Hand after the thing was just great. Quote, "The wind made me very uncomfortable to watch and sweaty. I told my family at home before I left that I had a good feeling about this race. I really felt that we could win. We worked really well together. That's what makes a difference. The three of us together, you may not think a German dude, a French guy who has a bunch of IndyCar championships, and a guy from California would work together the best, but we really do work well together." I love that.
Yeah.
A German dude.
Hey, one other topic we got to get to. Volkswagen and Bosch.
Cha-ching.
Yeah. Ching.
Yeah, so what was it, $325 million that Bosch decided that they were going to be paying, that was $327.5 million.
Yeah, that was their fine.
Right.
Right.
They're paying off a settlement, but of course they had no, they're not claiming any.
They were only doing what the client wanted. Then
Volkswagen, another $1.2 billion.
I think it's now up to something like, is it $21 billion or
something along those lines.
Incredible number.
I also went back and looked at their sales. The story broke in 2015, late 2015.
September. I was on vacation, I remember. Yeah.
So I looked at from that point to the end of last year, and my figuring is they lost at least another $1 billion in sales of cars they couldn't sell. So throw another billion on top of the number there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not over. I mean,
none
of the lawsuits have hit.
And the investigations haven't finished charges in Germany. So
what's your sense of Volkswagen in the United States? I mean, we saw that they had...
Long road back, you know. They were up 17% this last month, but a lot of that's they've got the buyback offers out. It's not clear how many people are taking those. But it's, they've got to get the right product out there. Because even before any of this hit, they didn't have the right product for the market. They didn't have the right sport utility vehicles. And then they've got to figure out what are they now that they don't have diesel. You know, that's not their thing. They've got to find a new brand or definition.
As they're pouring so much money into electric cars.
Yeah, okay.
Those are still years away.
Well, and look at how well electric cars are doing.
Right.
Unless
the big tipping point's out there.
We don't see it.
So do you think that if they come out with a whole suite of crossovers, that that is sufficient? Or is it going to be that vehicles like, you know, whether it's, you know, a CRV or a Highlander or a Traverse or an Explorer, I mean, that these are still going to get the lion's share of the business?
They're replacing the Tiguan. I think they're showing that in Chicago next week.
I think that's right.
Yeah. They showed the Atlas. I mean, that's a start.
But, I mean, is it enough? I mean,
well, I don't know that it's enough either.
You go back 5 years ago, Toyota was getting clobbered on this so-called unintended acceleration, and people were asking, is Toyota ever going to be able to make a comeback? No problem. If you go back even earlier to unintended acceleration in the mid-'80s with Audi, it got clobbered. Right. Took them a long time to come back, but they got back. So Volkswagen can do it. It's just a matter of how much does it cost and how long does it take?
And management commitment to it, because we have seen management in Germany, focus on the U.S. Then they totally neglect it. I mean, it's been a roller coaster for Volkswagen in terms of, I used to joke that, you know, it was an emerging market for the executives in Germany because their focus isn't, it's not been a consistent strategy in the U.S. And then that crazy a few years ago when they said, oh, we'll be selling 800,000 vehicles by 2018. I mean, that was ridiculous.
Right. Well, that's probably part of what drove them to cheat on part of it.
Right.
Hey, look, we're down to the end here. We did get some other questions from the viewers, so I'm going to throw these out to you guys. Dan Albert wants to know, was automobility at NAIS or CES, and how did it go? Well,
it was at Detroit. NAIS. Yeah.
So did you guys get down?
I can't speak to it because I was at it. I left town right after the thing.
Any?
I was barely healthy during that whole session.
Okay, well, then I'll answer. I thought it was pretty good, automobility. It's not CES. I don't think it's ever going to compete with CES. But I got to tell you, they did a really good job.
How did it compare to L.A.?
Way better than L.A. Way better. I mean, just visually, the way it was laid out. You know, in L.A., they put one of those big, temporary tents outside the convention center.
You couldn't tell what it was, really.
Yeah, it wasn't. I don't know. It was kind of hokey. But, they did a pretty good job. I met some very interesting people, a lot of startups, a lot of young people. I think they got something there. I really do. Okay, Guy Martineau wants to know, do you think automakers will ever make big family cars again? Nowadays, the larger they become, they're top-tier luxury models.
With these numbers we're seeing with sedans right across, I mean,
the new family car is the sport utility vehicle.
There's no question about it.
Not even that new, really.
Right. And, in fact, if you look at what are officially classified as full-size cars, I'm not counting the luxury ones, not the 7 Series and all, the numbers are puny.
3% of the market or less, I think.
Yeah.
Like Avalon, Taurus.
I want to say there was like 27,000 of them sold last month. Mm-hmm. Not a big number.
No.
But even if you look at if you just look at it from the point of view of Malibu, Fusion, Accord, Camry, Altima. I mean,
those aren't big family cars. Those I'm thinking about.
They're 5 passenger. You know, okay. I mean,
that's what he's talking about. I didn't take that definition.
Right, Taurus, Impala.
But even those cars are.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still a big part of the market, but it's.
Yeah.
Shrinking.
Okay. Next question. Fred wants to know, if Trump gets the corporate tax rate down to 15%, do you think FCA would move their headquarters back to Auburn Hills?
Oh, good question. I have no idea what's. I think there's a lot of question about what's going to happen to FCA.
I agree, and about the corporate tax rate.
Yeah, there's that too.
Is it all talk, or is anything going to happen?
Yeah.
And Atlabama wants to know: does the rollout of the Bolt seem glacial? Not available nationwide until late summer. Are they blowing their chance to steal Model 3 sales?
Well, they are being very aggressive in California, which is also Tesla's market. So I don't know.
I think it's only California, Oregon, Washington.
Right.
The numbers weren't that bad. I want to say they sold 1,200 last month.
Yeah,
and so if that's only in 3 states, yowza. I mean, I'm talking about from EV sales standpoint.
Which, again, is a teensy-weensy bit of the market.
1,162 Bolts were sold, and 1,611 Volts were sold. How many Leafs were sold?
This Leaf has struggled.
Well, yeah, I mean, who wants to go out and buy an 80-mile range car these days when you can get a Chevy Volt, well, Volt that EV that'll do 240?
A Leaf was 772. Yeah.
So we're talking tiny numbers, but, you know, for three states, I'm not, is it even Washington? I'm pretty sure it's California and Oregon, but.
Yeah, my guess is they are hyper careful. They know that if there's any quality problem, this car could get killed in childbirth.
And let's remember, this is how they sort of how they did it with the Volt, early Volt too. They're offering a special lease. You know, those
didn't work out so well for that car. So,
well, it started out, you know, but you know.
I think the plans are what, to be nationwide by late summer or something like that. I think Alabama makes a good point. It has been a glacial rollout, but that was
but I think
deliberate.
I mean, and remember how my point is about Volt is they took really good care of those customers.
Right.
And remember, they got great customer satisfaction ratings, even though the numbers of people who bought them were. Mm-hmm. And they've got to do that. They if they have a glitch and some, you know, something goes wrong, customers hate it, then they're in trouble.
Exactly right. Well, okay, good show. We got to wrap it up, though. Michelle, thanks so much for stopping
happy
by
to be
again.
Here.
Great to have you.
Happy
and,
to be here.
And, you know, I think you said a couple of times, I can't wait to drive the Continental. I'm sure they heard you.
I told them wait till spring. I don't want to mess up a beautiful car.
Really good.
Well, I had to get a salt on
it. Don't want to get dirty.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, Gary, you and I got to do this again next week.
We do.
And we'll be in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Chicago Auto Show.
So until then, folks, thanks for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.